I suppose, was the chance to live the American dream. We dreamed of having a house we could call our own, a decent-sized yard for the kids, a barbecue grill in the backyard. Just the basics, but the basics were out of reach, and after a series of long discussions with Kat, I finally talked to my boss about applying for a transfer to a territory in the southeast. My boss wasn't thrilled by my request. I'd only been with the company for 8 months, had only recently completed all my training, and was doing well in my territory. He didn't want to go through the process of hiring someone new, since there was always a risk the new employee wouldn't work out. And of course the territory would suffer while a new employee was being trained. That night I called Micah. "Micah," I said, "do you want a job selling pharmaceuticals?" My proposal made perfect sense to me. We'd run together, waited tables together, owned houses together, and he'd been part of the small company I'd started as well. We even looked somewhat alike. For a moment, Micah was taken aback. Though we'd done well in real estate, it was strictly commission work and was dominated by the large brokerage houses. Because he was with a smaller firm, finding new listings required endless hustle, and he'd grown tired of the way his firm dragged out paying him what he was owed. "What do you mean?" he finally asked. "If I get the transfer, I'll introduce you to my boss. You can interview with him, and I bet he'll hire you." "You think so?" "I know so." He thought about it overnight and called me the next morning. "Nick," he said, "I think I want to be a pharmaceutical rep." And lo and behold, after I received a new territory centered in New Bern, North Carolina, my brother was hired, took over my old territory in Sacramento, and I handed him the keys to my company car. Meanwhile, Kat and I began the process of getting ready for a new life on the other side of the country. In early November, less than a week after Micah accepted the job, I was at home and beginning the slow process of packing up our things when I got a frantic call from my father. "You've got to get to the hospital right now," my father suddenly said. He was breathless and scattered, a reprise of the fateful call 3 years ago. "She's at Methodist. Do you know where that is? Bob just brought her in a couple of minutes ago." Bob, I knew, was Dana's boyfriend, but my dad's garbled message didn't make sense. "Who? Are you talking about Dana? Is she okay?" "Dana, she's in the hospital." "Is she okay?" I repeated. "I don't know. I've got to get down there." My head suddenly began spinning with a sense of deja vu. "Do you know what happened? Was she in an accident?" "I don't know. I don't think so. Bob said she had a seizure of some sort. I don't know anything else. Mike is on his way. I'm heading there now." At the hospital, Bob told us what had happened. Bob lived on a ranch in Elk Grove and worked as a local trucker delivering feed for horses and cattle. Taller and heavier than Micah or me, he wore cowboy boots and had competed in bareback rodeo riding. I'd never seen him look as frightened as he did at that moment. "She woke up and she couldn't talk right," he said. "Her words were all mixed up and she didn't make any sense, so I loaded her in the car and we started for the hospital. On the way, her eyes rolled back and she started to convulse. She was still having the seizure when we got here. They took her back and I haven't seen her since." Though a different hospital, it was eerily reminiscent of the one where my mother had died. So were our feelings as we paced the small corridor waiting to hear what was going on, and so was the room where we eventually saw my sister. Dana was tired when we saw her. She'd been given medication for the seizure, and her eyes drooped. She, like us, was frightened, and she knew no more of what had happened to her than we did. But other than exhaustion, she seemed fine. She could tap the tips of her fingers against her thumb. She could remember everything from the night before. And she remembered realizing that something was wrong when she woke up earlier that morning. "I remember trying to talk," she said, somewhat groggily. "I can even remember hearing the words coming out. But they were the wrong words. So I tried to repeat myself, and the same thing happened again. And the smell. I kept smelling something really bad. That's when Bob put me in the car. I don't remember anything after that, though." Later, the doctor said she had had a grand mal seizure, though when pressed, he wouldn't speculate as to the reason until further tests came in. He did suggest that it was probably best if she rested for a while. I was the last one to get up to leave. Once the others had left the room, Dana asked me to stay. "Nick," she said, "tell me the truth. I want to know what's going on. Why did I have a seizure?" "There are lots of possible causes," I said. "I wouldn't worry too much."
"Like what?"
She searched my face, trusting me, wanting to know. My sister knew that I would always tell her the truth. "Anything, really," a sudden allergy, stress. Maybe you're epileptic, but the seizures hadn't been triggered until now. Brain tumor, maybe you ate something bad, dehydration. Something just made your body go haywire for a little while. Lots of people have seizures. Seizures are actually quite common. She looked at me, zeroing in on the one cause I'd hoped she would overlook. Brain tumor? She asked quietly. I shrugged. It can cause seizures, but believe me, it's not all that likely that you have one. I'd say it's the least likely of everything I mentioned. She glanced toward her lap. I don't want a brain tumor, she said. Don't worry, I reassured her, hoping to hide my fears. Like I said, that's probably not the reason. Over the next few weeks, Dana underwent a number of tests. The doctors couldn't find what was wrong with her. CAT scans were inconclusive, but since she had no more seizures, it seemed to us that the worst had passed. Still, the uncertainty weighed heavily on us. We still had no idea what had caused the seizure in the first place. It had also come time for me to move to North Carolina. Kat and I talked about it numerous times since Dana had gone to the hospital. She suggested that we might consider staying, even though I'd have to find another job. Dana might need us, she said. We can put our dreams on hold for a while, at least until we know what's going on. It was one of those choices in life without any ideal option. Let me talk to Micah, I finally said. Let me see what he thinks. That night, when I explained the guilt I felt about moving away, he put his hand on my shoulder. There's nothing you can do for Dana, he said. We don't even know what's wrong yet. But you've got to think about your family. You have a baby now. You've got to do what you think is best for him. I couldn't meet his eyes. I don't know. I'll watch out for Dana. I'm still here, and so is Dad. And you're only a flight away if we need you. It doesn't feel right to just leave, though. I don't want you to go either, he said. Then with a smile he added, But remember, Nick, what you want and what you get are usually two entirely different things. A few days before Christmas 1992, Kathy flew out with the baby to North Carolina to meet the moving van. I stayed behind to finish showing my brother around his new territory and introduce him to various doctors. Because our apartment had been emptied, I slept in my old room at Dad's house the night before my departure. Micah came over to help me pack my remaining items in the car. I would drive it cross-country. I noticed that he was wearing a pair of shorts of mine. Because we were the same size, we had borrowed each other's clothes for years. Micah had worked a couple of summers loading trucks for Consolidated Freightways and knew how to load the items to prevent them from being damaged. With the exception of the driver's seat, the car was completely filled. We were standing just inside the door when the time came to say goodbye. I'd already said my goodbyes to Dana and my dad, but it was time to go, and both Micah and I knew it. In the house were 1,000 memories. In my mind, I could hear Mom's laughter from the kitchen and see my brother and sister at the table. For the second time in my life, I was leaving my family. But this time was different. The last time I'd left, I'd been a teenager. Now I had a family of my own. I knew I'd never be moving back. It looks like when we loaded the Volkswagen to move here, doesn't it? I cracked. It's pretty full, but at least it's level this time. How long will it take you to get there? 4 days or so. Drive safe. I will. We hugged. I'm going to miss you, I said. I'll miss you too. I love you, Micah. He squeezed harder. I love you too, little brother. When we separated, I could feel the tears coming, but tried to hold them back. We'd come to depend heavily on each other in the last 3 years, but I tried to diminish the significance of what was happening. I told myself that we were simply moving. It wasn't as if we wouldn't see each other again. I'd come to visit him, and he'd come to see me. We'd talk on the phone. You're wearing my shorts, I said randomly. I'll give them to you tomorrow, he said without thinking. No, he added quickly. I won't. You'll be gone tomorrow. I can't give them to you. At that, Micah began to cry, and he leaned into me again. It's okay, Micah, I whispered, beginning to cry as well. It's gonna be all right. And a few minutes later, through my own blurry tears, I saw his image in the rearview mirror grow smaller. He was standing on the lawn, forcing a smile, and slowly waving goodbye. Chapter 14. Jaipur and Agra, India, February 7th to 8th. We landed in Jaipur, a city of 2.5 million people in northern India and the capital of the state of Rajasthan. Famous for its forts, palaces, and colorful culture, Jaipur is frequently called the Pink City and is the commercial center for most of the rural regions of Rajasthan. Though we weren't sure what to expect, we quickly learned that India was a country like no other. After showing our passport in 3 different places, we boarded the bus that would take us through the city of Jaipur to the Amber Fort, which was once home to the Maharaja. Our guide spoke perfect Indian-accented English, and as we made our way across the city of Jaipur, he informed us that Jaipur is regarded as one of India's most beautiful cities. He seemed to believe it as well. In the 40 minutes it took to reach our destination, he would point out various monuments and explain what they were. His favorite words, as far as we could tell, were Jaipur, beautiful, and pink. Every description contained or ended with a variation of the following. Jaipur, the beautiful city. Jaipur, the pink city. Look, can you see how beautiful it is? The landscape is beautiful, and the buildings in the old town are painted pink. Jaipur is the pink city. Jaipur is the beautiful city. Meanwhile, Micah and I were staring out the windows with our mouths agape. People were everywhere. The sidewalks and streets were packed, and our bus shared the roads with pedestrians, scooters, bicycles, camels, elephants, donkeys, and horse-drawn carts, all moving at different speeds and zigzagging in traffic. Cows, sacred in the Hindu culture, roamed freely throughout the city, nosing through piles of garbage along with dogs and goats. The poverty struck us forcefully. Ragged tent sites and houses slapped together with rotting boards or whatever discarded materials could be found were home to tens of thousands of people. They lined the main thoroughfare and all the crossroads we passed. People dressed in rags were everywhere, and dozens, if not hundreds, were sleeping in the gutter. People defecated and urinated in plain view, yet no one but us seemed even to notice. The smell of diesel fuel was overwhelming. Meanwhile, our guide continued. Look at the fancy houses just beyond the walls. Can you see how beautiful they are? In the old town, all the buildings are pink. Jaipur is the pink city. Jaipur is the beautiful city. Micah leaned over to me. Where are the fancy houses again? I think he said they're behind the walls over there. See those roofs? You mean behind the slums? Yeah. And this is a beautiful city. He's got to be out of his mind. At that point, one of the other members of our tour, who was sitting behind us, leaned forward. Actually, he said, Jaipur is wealthy when compared to some of the other cities in India. You can't even begin to imagine what Calcutta or Bombay look like. It's worse than this? Micah asked. By a long shot. Believe it or not, Jaipur is the beautiful city. After that, all we could do was stare out the windows, wondering how on earth people survived like this. The Amber Fort, located 6 miles from the city, was built atop a hill and is surrounded by peaks and easily defended valleys that made it ideal for protection of the Maharaja. At the base of the fort, we broke into groups of 4 and rode elephants up the long, winding road that led to a large courtyard that served as the entrance to the fort itself. It took some time for our entire group to arrive at the gates. We'd needed over 20 elephants, and they moved slowly. Micah and I quickly learned that Indian vendors were even more aggressive than those in Peru. They crowded around us in groups of 4 to 6, all of them holding trinkets, undercutting each other's prices. It didn't matter if we said no or walked away. They simply followed us, each of them almost shouting to get our attention. If we refused a second time, they closed in tighter and spoke even louder. The people in the tour first to arrive at the fort clustered in a defensive circle, backs to the crowd, trying hard to ignore the shouts. The vendors kept at it for over 30 minutes. In the end, they would follow our group right up to the door. We toured the Amber Fort for the next hour, marveling at the blend of Hindu and Muslim architecture. There were spacious scenic courtyards, high-quality paintings and frescoes, and individual apartments for the dozen concubines of the Maharaja. We took photographs in front of a large garden that used an ingenious system of irrigation to enable the flowers to bloom year-round, and eventually made our way to the upper levels, where we could appreciate the fort's location from a defensive standpoint. Yet it was the Hall of Mirrors that was most impressive. It was our first exposure to the intricate marble work for which the fort had become famous, and up close the workmanship was of higher quality than anything we'd seen. Built over 10 years and using 2,000 workers, the Hall of Mirrors has marble walls inlaid with tens of thousands of precious and semi-precious stones, as well as thousands of tiny mirrors. In the evening, we were told that the Maharaja would be entertained by candlelight in front of the hall, where the stones and mirrors would reflect the gentle light. While the relief carvings of Angkor Wat had been detailed, even I understood that it was far more difficult to work with marble. Every one of the tens of thousands of inlaid gems and mirrors fit perfectly. "It's incredible," Michael whispered. "But I think it's almost too much. A little gaudy for my tastes." "Well, that's all right. I don't think you can find anyone who even knows how to do work like this anymore. Unless you move to India, of course." "I don't think that's going to happen." After leaving the fort, we drove through one slum after the next, passed through the gate, and, in a way that only India can truly surprise, found ourselves in paradise. Our hotel was once a palace owned by the Maharaja. The rooms were laid out in cabana style, and the grounds were impeccable. Lush with trees, fountains, winding paths, and flowers, there was also a full-service health spa, tennis courts, fitness center, and swimming pool. The employees were both professional and efficient. If we so much as glanced in their direction, they rushed toward us to see if there was anything they could do. Every member of the tour was escorted to his or her rooms by individuals who not only explained the features of the rooms in exceptional detail, but offered to pick up laundry and shine shoes as well, with the promise that everything would be returned within a couple of hours. It was the most luxurious hotel we would stay in on the tour, yet no matter how nice it was, neither Micah nor I could escape the reality that we knew lay just outside the door. In the evening, we attended yet another cocktail party and had our heads wrapped in turbans for our visit to the city palace. There, we were greeted in typically royal fashion. Contingents of guards stood at attention alongside camels, white stallions, and elephants, all of which had been decorated for our arrival. We had dinner and were treated to a show with traditional Indian entertainers, but both Micah and I were tired from the day and looked forward to nothing more than getting back to our room and crashing. In the morning, we had two choices. We could visit the museum and various shopping areas, or simply stay at the hotel. Micah and I stayed at the hotel. Neither one of us had any desire to leave the sanctuary of our compound, and for the first time in 2 weeks, we did absolutely nothing at all. In the afternoon, Micah was wearing sunglasses and a bathing suit, relaxing in a lounge chair near the pool. "Now this," Micah said, "is exactly what I needed." "I know what you mean," I said. "I feel sort of guilty, though. It could be my last chance to see India, and we're sitting by the pool at the hotel. Did you really want to see another museum and go shopping?" "No, I'm just saying that it makes me feel guilty." "You always feel guilty. That's your problem." "I thought my problem was that I didn't have enough friends." "That too." I opened my arms wide in mock gratitude. "That's why I like you, Micah. You're always willing to offer constructive criticism." "I'm glad to help. Besides, someone had to take over after Mom died." "She was irreplaceable." "You know what she was?" Micah reflected. "She was like the center of the wheel in our family, and we were all the spokes. And once she was gone, we didn't have our center anymore. I think that's why the loss hit us so hard. Not only was Mom gone, but we had to become a new kind of family. I think that's why you, me, and Dana started to get close again." "What about Dad?" "I don't know," he said. "Part of it was losing Mom, but I still think Dad was manic depressive. When Mom was around, I think she was able to keep his mood swings under control. But after she was gone, well, Dad didn't have a center either." "Do you think he was a good dad? When we were growing up, I mean?" "In some ways, not so good in others. But you know, in the end, you have to give them both credit for being good parents simply because of the way their kids turned out. We're happily married, successful, ethical, and we remain close as siblings. If your kids can say the same thing later in life, won't you think you did a good job as a parent?" "Without a doubt," I conceded. In the morning, we flew to Agra, where we'd visit the Taj Mahal. Agra held the same sights outside our bus windows as Jaipur, with two major differences. There was far more pollution in the air, and far more roads were unpaved. Because of the pollution, we had to change buses. To reach the Taj, we'd ride the last couple of miles in electric buses, and ended up stopping a quarter mile from the gates. From where we parked, it was impossible to see the Taj Mahal. What most people don't realize is that the Taj is actually part of a massive compound. Again, we waited in a long line, this one to check our bags for explosives or weapons, and we finally entered the compound. Even then, we couldn't see the monument. Instead, we filed along a sidewalk flanked on either side by what had essentially been apartments for guests of Shah Jahan. Up ahead and to the right was a large brick structure that served as a massive ornamental gate, and again we had to wait in line and be checked before passing through. On the other side, however, we finally had our first glimpse of what some regard as the finest monument to love ever constructed. The Taj Mahal was begun in 1631 by Shah Jahan, a Mughal emperor, in memory of his second wife, Mumtaz Mahal, who died after giving birth to their 14th child. It is, in other words, a tomb. The cenotaph honoring Mumtaz Mahal inside the Taj is inlaid with jewels and lies near that of her husband's. The Taj is one of the most symmetrical buildings ever constructed. The cenotaph of Mumtaz is directly in the center of the dome. The four corner towers are exactly the same distance from the dome, and exactly the same height. The Taj took 20,000 workers, 1,000 elephants, and 22 years to build, and material was brought in from all over India and Central Asia. It is regarded as a symbol of eternal love, yet Shah Jahan spent little time there. Soon after it was completed, Shah Jahan's son and Mumtaz's son deposed the emperor and imprisoned him in the Great Red Fort a few miles away. While Shah Jahan could see the Taj from his prison cell, he was never allowed to set foot in the Taj Mahal again. From where we stood, it didn't look real. Set against a murky, polluted sky, the marble shone brilliantly and the image was reflected in the long rectangular ponds before it. Most people, when seeing pictures of the Taj Mahal, which means Crown Palace, believe it's constructed of white, unadorned marble. Only up close does the detail of each marble block become vivid. Like the Hall of Mirrors, only on a much larger and grander scale, the Taj Mahal is adorned with precious and semi-precious stones, inlaid in the shapes of flowers and vines. After taking pictures, we made the walk to the monument itself and studied the ornamental facade. "Now that's a lot of marble," Micah offered succinctly. We spent a little more than an hour at the Taj Mahal, which surprisingly sufficed. The Taj, after all, is a crypt. There is not much inside other than the small room where Mumtaz and eventually Shah Jahan were buried, and most attention is directed to the detail of the marble blocks used in the construction. And it is amazing. Yet because the Taj had been built with such mathematical precision, the artistry seemed curiously uninspiring. If you found a design on one side, the exact same design was mechanically replicated on the opposite side. While a marvel of construction, it was strangely repetitious. Both Micah and I were fascinated by the fact that the son had imprisoned the father and never let him set foot in the Taj Mahal, the crypt of his own mother, during the last years of Shah Jahan's life. "You see," Micah said with a knowing nod, "that's exactly what I was talking about. Dad was a lot better father than old Shah Jahan must have been. His kid hated him." I nodded in agreement. And yet, as I stared up at the massive monument to Mumtaz, I found myself thinking not about my father, but about my sister. In January 1993, less than 3 weeks after I moved to North Carolina, I was back in California. Right after the New Year, my sister had gone to see a new physician. He had ordered a new MRI from a different hospital. MRI scanning machines at that time were undergoing rapid technological change, and the newer machines were able to provide images that their predecessors were not. Dana's image, we were told, had been taken on a dated machine. A new image might provide the answers. She lay on the bed, put earplugs in, and was rolled into the machine. The machine makes loud clanking noises, like someone banging a pan with a spoon, and within a few hours the scans were ready. And there, plain as day, was something that wasn't supposed to be there. Dana, we learned, had a brain tumor. She was scheduled for immediate surgery at UC San Francisco, and I flew out to join Micah and my dad. In the hotel the night before, Micah and I tried to keep the mood upbeat, but my dad was extremely tense throughout the evening. It was only when Micah and I were alone that we felt comfortable enough to talk about our own fears and worries. Our sister, our younger sister, had a brain tumor. As if losing our mother hadn't been hard enough, we now had to confront this. The surgery was scheduled for early in the morning, and we brought Dana to the hospital a little before 7. Because of tight schedules, however, the surgery didn't begin until nearly noon, making the day one of the longest in our lives. It wasn't until after 7 p.m. that the doctor came to talk to us. He told us the surgery had gone well, and that they'd removed as much of the tumor as they could. It hadn't been possible to remove it all. Parts of the tumor had spread to areas deep within her brain, and other parts were intertwined with areas of the brain that performed vital functions. To have removed every speck of the tumor, the doctor informed us, would have left Dana in a vegetative state. It took a long time for the doctor to explain Dana's condition to us in a way that we'd eventually understand. We wanted specifics. How much of the tumor is left? Where is it located? What does it mean in the long run? But brain surgery, we would come to learn, is often more about judgment than rules. When she recovers, the doctor said, she'll start her anti-seizure medication and begin radiation. Hopefully, that will kill whatever was left of the tumor, the parts we couldn't get to. What if the radiation doesn't work? What then? Do we do surgery again? The doctor shook his head. Let's just hope the radiation does work. Like I said, I couldn't get to parts of the tumor without making her a lot worse. What are her chances? Is she going to make it? It depends on the type of tumor. We're having it biopsied now. Some tumors are more susceptible to radiation than others. Some grow quickly, and some don't. We won't know for sure until the results come in. But if the tumor's susceptible, the radiation should take care of it. So there's a chance she can still lead a normal life. The doctor shifted. For the most part. We waited, wondering what he meant, and the doctor finally went on. The anti-seizure medication is contraindicated in pregnancy because of possible birth defects. The doctor paused. Mike and I glanced at each other, already knowing what was coming. More than likely, the doctor added, she'll never have children. None of us said anything for a long time. When can we see her? I finally asked. Tomorrow. She's sleeping, and it's probably best if she rests for a while. That night, Micah and I slept in the same hotel room, or rather tried to sleep. For the most part, all I could do was stare at the ceiling, thinking about a conversation Dana and I had had on our birthday long ago.
I want to be married, and I want to have kids, my sister had said. That's it? That's it. That's all I want out of life.
The memory nearly broke my heart. My sister's head was heavily wrapped in bandages when we saw her. Mostly she slept, and when she woke, she was groggy. Her gaze was unfocused, her movements lethargic.
Did it go okay? She stammered out.
Her voice was a whisper.
It went great, sweetheart, Micah said. Oh, good.
I love you, sweetie, I said.
Love you both.
And then she slept again. A week later, we had the results of the biopsy. My sister had essentially 3 types of cancerous cells in her brain. Oligodendroglioma, astrocytoma, and glioblastoma multiforme. All are fast-growing tumors that spread in spider-like fashion. They are only partially susceptible to radiation and chemotherapy. As we learned what we could about it, only one fact about the tumors stood out in our minds. Though all could be deadly, one form of her tumor was essentially so. After 5 years, the survival rate for those with glioblastoma multiforme was less than 2%. My sister had just turned 26. I returned to North Carolina 3 days later, the morning my sister was to be released from the hospital. In addition to learning that she'd need radiation, my sister was put on the anti-seizure medication. With her head bandaged, she began the slow process of healing. The guilt I felt about not being with her left me aching for weeks, and I threw myself into work. Yet life eked on, bringing with it additional sources of stress. My new boss immediately began exerting pressure on me to perform. Kat and I bought our first house. In the span of 3 months, we'd moved, changed jobs, bought a house, began the process of remodeling, and worried incessantly about my sister. That wasn't all. My sister's diagnosis was almost too much for my father to bear, and my relocation to North Carolina only seemed to feed the anger and guilt he felt inside. Again, I was the outlet for his rage and sense of helplessness. When I told him about our new house, for example, he responded by tersely informing me that I'd better not expect any help with the down payment. When he called, he spoke only to my wife. Usually I stood by waiting for my chance to visit, only to hear Kathy say, "Well, Nick is here. Do you want to say hi?" There would be a long pause before Kat would go on. "Oh, well, okay then. Bye, Dad. Love you." Then, ever so quietly, she'd hang up the phone. "He didn't want to talk to me?" I'd ask. "It's not you," she'd whisper, taking me in her arms. "He's just scared." With Dana, my dad kept up a brave front. He brought her to her appointments, and in April, when the radiation started, she moved back into the house. The radiation made her sick and caused her to lose a good deal of hair on the side of her head. But she sounded upbeat whenever I'd call. My sister, always an optimist at heart, knew she'd be okay. "I've been praying, Nick," she told me once, "and I think it's working. It's like I can feel the tumors dying. I like to imagine them screaming in agony as they're dying." "I'm sure they are. You're young and strong. Will you pray for me, too?" "You don't have to ask, Dana. I've been praying for you every day." "Thanks," she said. "How's Dad holding up?" "He's been great. You can't believe how helpful he is. He cooks me soup and even bought me a television with a remote so I don't have to get up to change the channel." "Good. I'm glad. So how are you doing? Anything exciting going on?" I hesitated. There was something more, but part of me didn't want to answer. How could I tell her? At the same time, I knew my sister would find out eventually. Others in the family, including Micah, already knew. "Well, we just found out that Kat is pregnant again," I finally said. "The baby's due in September." For a long time, my sister was silent. "That's wonderful," she finally said. Her voice was subdued. "I'm happy for you two." "Did you tell her?" Micah asked me a few minutes later. I'd called him immediately after hanging up with Dana. "Yeah," I told her. "How'd she take it?" "About like I expected. It's terrible, isn't it? I mean, she'd be a great mother. She's just like Mom was." I said nothing. There was nothing really to say. "I've been thinking about you," Micah finally added. "And the way things have been happening lately." "What do you mean?" "I'm talking about the highs and lows. First, you get married, and you're on an incredible high. 6 weeks later, Mom dies, and it's impossible to get any lower. Kat gets pregnant for the first time, then has a miscarriage. You and Kat make the decision to move, and you're excited about starting a new life. A month later, Dana has a seizure, and we find out she has a brain tumor. Then you learn that Kathy's pregnant again. At the same time, we find out that Dana can't have kids, and she isn't likely to live more than 5 years. It's like you've been living on a roller coaster that's racing up and down without hitting a level area. For you, it's been the highest of highs and the lowest of lows." "I could say the same thing about you," I offered quietly. "And Dad, too." "I know," he said. "It kind of takes the joy out of those highs, doesn't it?" Dana's radiation ended halfway through the summer, and remarkably, her CAT scan came back clear. The doctors were optimistic. My sister's hair began growing back slowly, and for the first time since the seizure, our worries about her were relegated to the background. With my sister's improvement, my dad's behavior toward me changed for the better as well. He began speaking to me on the phone again. It was tentative at first, a hesitant rapprochement. He still talked to Kat at great length, however, and we learned that he'd actually begun dating again. He'd met a woman, he said, and he liked her a lot. Dana, too, was getting along better with Bob. After the surgery, their relationship had been rocky. And Micah, as usual, kept humming along, escaping for long weekends and avoiding all serious relationships. In September 1993, Ryan was born, though I wasn't at the hospital for his birth. Instead, I was out of town on business, a meeting I couldn't miss, and Kat's water broke just as the meeting was ending. I wouldn't arrive to see my son until the following day. In November, our family reunited in Texas for Thanksgiving with my dad's younger brother, Monty, and I was struck by the fact that my father seemed genuinely happy. He'd fallen in love, he said, and all three of us were pleased that he'd finally found someone whose company he enjoyed. This news, however, about our father suddenly seemed less important than what else we learned on that trip. Dana told us that she and Bob had broken up again. This wasn't entirely unexpected. The stress of her recent illness would have been enough to test any relationship. Oh, I remember saying. That's too bad. I like Bob. There's more, though, my sister said. What's that? She smiled, offering the faintest of shrugs. I'm pregnant, she said. I didn't know what to say. Don't worry, I've stopped taking my anti-seizure medicine. There was even more. In our family, I was slowly beginning to realize there was always something more. Not only was my sister seriously jeopardizing her health, a worry that would plague us over the next 7 months, but well on her way to becoming a single mother. We soon found out she was expecting twins. Then, increasing our worries, right after Christmas, my dad abruptly informed my sister she had to move out of the house despite the fact she had nowhere else to go. Though I never told anyone, I secretly began to wonder if my father was not only manic depressive, but mentally ill in other ways as well. In December, my dad learned that the woman he'd been dating, the first woman he'd dated after my mom's death, hadn't actually been divorced. Instead, she'd only been separated from her husband and had been using my father for the little money he had. By the end of the relationship, my father was deep in debt. When he could afford nothing more, she cut off contact entirely. I don't know whether my dad kept calling the woman and she finally grew tired of his persistence, or whether it was accidental, but her husband eventually found out about the relationship. The husband was a burly police officer, and he'd physically threatened my dad in the driveway of my dad's home. My father had been terrified by the confrontation, even fearing for his life. It was this turn of events, right around Christmas, I believe, that finally broke him emotionally. From that point on, my dad embarked on a downward spiral that only grew worse over time. His mood and attitude were bitter, and he became not only angry, but paranoid as well. Because he couldn't go to the police, what good would it have done? He bought guns and ammunition instead. He asked my sister to move out of the house, and then he bought a dog named Flame. Flame, a German shepherd, had originally been trained for police duty, but because of his volatile nature, couldn't be used. Though attached to my dad, Flame made everyone else nervous. The dog growled and snapped, seemingly at random, and wasn't trustworthy. His combustible personality, combined with my father's instability, made for a dangerous mix. During the first few months of 1994, my brother and I talked endlessly on the phone about both our sister and our father, wondering what, if anything, we could do. Should I invite Dana to live out here with us? I asked. She can't, Nick, Micah answered. Her doctors are out here. What about Dad? She's adamant that she can't live at home anymore. And to be honest, I really don't want her living there either. He's really getting strange these days, and with Flame... No, Dana can't stay there. Not if she has kids. Can she stay with you? I've asked, but she says she doesn't want to. She says she can handle it. Her friend Olga has a small room that she says Dana can rent. Olga lived in the old farmhouse where we boarded our horses. She'd known Dana for years. How's she going to handle it? She has no job, no husband, no money. She has a brain tumor. I know, I try to tell her that. What does she say? She says that she'll make do. She isn't worried at all. She's excited about having kids. How can she not be worried? What if she has a seizure and no one's around to help her? She has faith that it'll all work out. I hesitated. Do you think that's enough? I don't know, he answered. Thankfully, my sister made it through her pregnancy uneventfully, and in May 1994, she delivered healthy twin boys she named Cody and Cole. Within a week of her delivery, she was back on her anti-seizure medication, and she began taking care of the babies in the cramped room she called home. Micah and I sent her money, and somehow it was enough for her to survive. Dana and the twins slept on a fold-out mattress on a wooden floor for 2 months. By the end of the summer, however, my sister had reconciled with Bob and had decided to move in with him so the boys could live with their father. Surprising us, she hadn't told him that she'd been pregnant until right before the twins had been born. During that time, my dad devoted most of his time to working with the dog. Despite my sister's apparent good health, his anger only grew worse. In that 6-month period, he began to estrange himself from the rest of his extended family. He refused to take calls from his mother, father, or siblings. If they sent a letter, he returned it unopened. Nor would he talk to me, or Micah and Dana, about his reasons for cutting them out of his life. If we asked him what was going on, he grew furious with us, right to nuclear launch, and through gritted teeth would tell us that it was none of your damn business. For whatever reason, he'd begun to blame his family for all the problems he'd had in his life. At the time, however, I'd been through so many ups and downs that I somehow believed my dad would get through this as well. My father, I eventually found out, began seeing a psychiatrist around that time, which both my brother and I thought would help. But my dad, I alone seemed to recognize, had been maintaining a Jekyll and Hyde existence for years. He could fool people, indeed no one at work ever mentioned that anything seemed amiss, and I think he was able to fool the psychiatrist as well. Instead of putting my father on antidepressants, which I think would have benefited him, the doctor instead prescribed Valium, which only made matters worse. With Dana and Bob back together, the twins healthy and Dad limiting, though not cutting off contact with us, Micah concentrated on work, excelled at his job, and continued to date. As for me, 3,000 miles from the rest of my family, life went on as usual, with one small exception. Right after Kat and I celebrated our 5th anniversary, and using my wife's grandparents as inspiration, I began writing again. Throughout 1993 and 1994, my brother and I saw quite a bit of each other, despite the distance between us. The pharmaceutical company we worked for would hold national sales meetings to promote their new product releases. In addition, training sessions were conducted out of the home offices in New Jersey, and Micah and I would inevitably end up in the same sessions. He also visited me in North Carolina, and I would make it out to California at least once a year. As always, we would talk about Dana and my dad. Because my brother was the conduit I used to follow the goings-on in the family, I needed to talk to him. Because I was the only one with whom he could speak freely, he needed to talk to me, too. In late 1994, we were at a national sales conference and relaxing after a day of meetings when the same subjects arose. "How's Dad doing?" I asked. "Who knows, but I think he's met someone new and he's dating again." "Does he ever go to see the twins?" "No, not really." "Have you asked him why?" "He'd rather spend the weekend with his dog." "He didn't say that." "Not in so many words, but that's the way he acts. It's like the dog and this new woman are the only things he cares about anymore." "Any word on why he won't talk to his family?" "No." "But he's dating?" "Yeah, can you believe it? Half the time I think he's getting better. But when you look at the whole picture..." He trailed off. "I hope he snaps out of it, but this time I'm not so sure. He seems so angry all the time." "How's Dana?" "The babies are keeping her busy. Her last CAT scan was good. There's no sign of the tumor." "But man, you should see those boys. They're so cute. It almost makes me want kids." "Almost?" "Not now," he said quickly. "In a few years, I mean." I laughed. "So what do you think of all the buyout and merger rumors we've been hearing lately?" Micah asked. We'd heard that American Cyanamid, the parent company of Letterly Labs, was supposedly on the sales block, and thus all of the attendees at the meeting had been worried about the possibility of losing their jobs. "Who knows? Whatever happens, happens. After everything we've been through, I'm sure we'll land on our feet." Less than 2 weeks after the meeting, as 1994 was coming to a close, we learned that the company was to be bought by American Home Products. In January, the company began the slow process of restructuring. To keep my job, I had to move to Greenville, South Carolina. Micah was offered a position just south of Los Angeles. While I reluctantly took the transfer, my brother decided to give up his job. "I can't leave," he said to me. "This is my home, and besides, I can't leave Dana and Dad." "What are you going to do?" "I'll probably go back to real estate and see what happens." "How's your novel coming along?" "It's just about done. Before editing, I mean." "Are you going to try to get this one published?" "I think so." "Is it better than the first two you wrote?" "I guess I'll find out." "Hey, maybe you'll be out of the pharmaceutical business soon, too." "Maybe," I sighed. "We'll see how it goes." I'd given up trying to predict the future. Chapter 15. Lalibela, Ethiopia. February 9th to 10th. We'd started the morning in Jaipur. had flown to Agra to see the Taj Mahal, and later that afternoon we boarded the plane once more for a flight to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. We arrived late, landing well after dark. Even in darkness, Addis Ababa surprised us. Our impressions of Ethiopia were largely based on what we'd seen on television or read about in newspapers, and I suppose I imagined a city similar to Phnom Penh or even Jaipur. Yet Addis was far more similar to Lima, and we were struck by its cosmopolitan atmosphere. Long, well-manicured green belts lined the main thoroughfare. The streets were clean, well-lit, and used only by cars, and for the first time in weeks we saw elements of American culture. Billboards advertised Coca-Cola and jeans from the Gap. Our guide spoke excellent English, and when we asked him about the city, he nodded. Yes, Addis is a modern city, but it is not normally this clean. What do you mean? Last week they held a major meeting with all the nations of Africa represented. The government has been cleaning the city for weeks to make a good impression. Still, there's only so much cleaning one could do. Addis Ababa, on the surface anyway, seemed incredibly, almost shockingly wealthy compared to the cities we'd recently visited. In the morning, we rode back to the airport and boarded two small propeller-driven planes for the flight to Lalibela. Lalibela is the spiritual home of the Abyssinian or Ethiopian Orthodox Church, but is most famous for the monolithic cave churches carved in the 13th century. King Lalibela had ordered their construction, and using 40,000 slaves, 11 cave churches were carved from stone. What makes the churches unique is that they don't sit above ground. Instead, they had been carved into the earth so that the roof lines of the churches are at ground level. The airport where we landed was located in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by peaks of the Ethiopian highlands. Aside from the airport, there were no other buildings at all, and the land was reminiscent of southern Nevada near the Sierras. Few trees grew in the rocky soil, and low-lying scrubs stretched across the valley as far as the eye could see. Lalibela, we learned, was roughly 25 miles away and 2,000 feet higher in elevation. The winding asphalt road curved through the valley and along the peaks. In the hour it took to reach our destination, we never saw another vehicle. We did, however, see a young boy around 10 years of age, 8 miles from Lalibela. Walking along the road, he was hauling a monstrously overstuffed burlap bag of charcoal that he intended to deliver to the city. The bag, both taller and wider than the child, had been strapped to his back and looked many times heavier than the child himself. When he saw our bus passing, he smiled and waved a greeting before continuing his slow march to the town. Most of the town of Lalibela was situated off the main highway, along bumpy gravel roads. Its thatched roof, adobe homes, featured few glass windows, but the town boasted numerous places to eat, small family-owned businesses, and souvenir shops. Nearly everyone we saw wore Western clothing. A number of tables lined the roads, offering various T-shirts, most emblazoned with American logos. For all intents and purposes, the town of Lalibela was an Ethiopian tourist trap. Our buses parked near the carved rock churches, and as soon as we stepped off the bus, we were besieged by teens. Unlike other places we'd visited, they had no trinkets for sale. Instead, they asked for money. Every child who came up to us told us that he needed money either to attend school or to buy the books he needed at the school he was currently attending. In the end, they were forced back by Ethiopian guards swinging sticks. Lalibela was one of the least known sites we would visit on the trip. Few knew what to expect. We weren't disappointed. The vast amount of labor needed for construction, literally carving through rock by hand, was evident as soon as we gazed upon the first church we would visit. It was far larger than we'd imagined, at least 60 feet long and 40 feet wide. It was surrounded by modern scaffolding that supported a roof over the top. The roof is to prevent leaks, the guide informed us, and to keep the churches from decaying. We spent the next couple of hours wandering from one church to the next. The churches were dark inside. Few had windows, and though fluorescent lights had been strung inside, they barely permeated the blackness. The floors were slick, polished by 800 years of use to an almost icy smoothness. Because the churches are still in use today, throw rugs have been placed throughout. Unfortunately, they didn't cover the floor in its entirety, and we moved slowly like blind men in foreign surroundings to prevent us from falling. In all, we would spend 3 hours in Lalibela. Toward the end of our visit, Micah and I wandered off to take pictures. Because the churches were so different from everything we'd seen up to that point, carved into stone rather than built with stone, we tried to find vantage points that could capture how unique they were. The visits to the churches had left Micah strangely silent, and as I was snapping away, he went to sit on one of the ledges overlooking the site. I eventually walked over to join him. "So what did you think of this place?" Micah finally asked. "It was worth seeing, if that's what you mean. They're not exactly like the churches we have back home, are they? I don't think the kids would appreciate having to stand the whole time during the service." He smiled. "Are you glad you still go to Mass?" "As opposed to what? Going to another Christian church?" I thought about it. "Yeah," I said. "I am. But Kat is Catholic too, so we've never considered changing. I like the church I go to now, or used to anyway." "Why?" "I don't know. I guess I just got bored that Mass always seemed the same, and I couldn't relate the sermons to my life. I think church should make you feel close to God, but I wasn't getting that with the new church I did for a while." "Do you think you'll ever feel that way again?" "I don't know. I haven't felt close to God lately. I'm not even sure that I believe in God anymore."
"Really?"
"Not God, per se. I think God exists, but I'm not so sure that he takes an active role in the world. I think he put everything in motion, and since then he's just sitting back watching how it's going to turn out."
"Hmm," I responded. "Go on."
"It's not what they tell you in church, obviously. In church, you're supposed to pray and be thankful. But like I said before, I've come to the conclusion that prayer doesn't work. And for a long time there, it wasn't easy to be thankful for much. We went through one big challenge after the next. They just didn't let up. And everyone kept telling me to be strong, that it would work out in the end." I knew Micah wasn't looking for a response. "And after a while, it just kind of hit me. What do I really believe? I followed the commandments, I believed in Jesus, I went to church, and I prayed all the time. And when I really needed God's help, it was like the only answer I got was, 'Who cares?' I didn't want God to give me strength to endure whatever was happening. I wanted God to put an end to what was happening, and he didn't, so I quit." I said nothing. When it comes to matters of faith, the best response is to say nothing unless you're asked directly.
"Didn't you ever feel that way?" he said.
"Yeah," I said, "all the time."
"But it didn't hit you the way it hit me."
"No."
"Why not?"
"I don't know," I sighed. "I guess I didn't think any of the bad stuff was really God's fault in the first place. Things just happen. And if God didn't cause them, I guess I didn't expect him to change it."
He nodded, then said, "I still get sad about everything that happened. Every now and then it just hits me. Sometimes it takes days for me to get over it."
I put my arm around his shoulder.
"That happens to me too."
"What do you do?"
I shrugged.
"Work," I offered. He laughed.
"Yeah, your balance is totally out of whack."
"Yours too. Work, spirituality, family, friendships, health. You can't ignore any of them, or it'll get you in the end."
"Are you saying that I'm as bad as you?"
"Sure," I said. "We're brothers. We reacted to the stress in different ways. But to be honest, I think our situations are more alike than you realize. We went through the same things, didn't we?"
By early 1995, my sister had been in remission for 2 years and had become a mother. Her CAT scans continued to come up clear. With every passing month, our worries began to diminish. At the same time, though, all three of us became more and more concerned about our father. His behavior outside work was growing worse. Though heavily in debt, he began spending money like crazy. He remodeled the house and bought a new SUV. And whenever he spoke to us on the phone, his only interest seemed to be in talking about Flame. Despite having a new girlfriend, his world seemed to revolve around the dog. The estrangement from his family continued. Frequently I'd get calls from relatives wondering what was going on, yet there was nothing I could say except that I didn't understand what was happening any better than they did. He was distant and on edge whenever I called. His conversations with Kat had grown short. and Dana was busy with twins and living on the far side of town, which brought them into little contact with each other. Even Micah was having trouble making sense of what was going on. When pressed, my dad would swear that he'd never been happier, that work was going well, that he loved his weekends with the dog and his girlfriend. 20 minutes later, however, long after Micah had asked him how he was doing and had moved on to discussing other things, my dad would launch into DEFCON 5, suddenly turning to Micah and snarling, "My life isn't your damn business anyway, so why don't you get the hell out of here?" Bizarre, hurtful, worrisome. Yet Kat and I were so far removed from the situation that we wouldn't learn the full story of what was going on until years later. We were caught up in yet another move while raising two young boys. For the first couple of months, Kat had to stay in New Bern to try to sell the house, while I lived in a small apartment in Greenville. During the days, I worked at establishing a new territory. In the evenings, I'd drive around looking for a house we could buy. On the weekends, I'd either head back home, or Kat would come to Greenville to view the homes that I'd found. By the end of May, we finally moved into our new home in Greenville, and spent the first few weeks meeting our neighbors, learning the layout of the town, and making new friends. Miles had always been outgoing and friendly. He met lots of kids and frequently played with them. Ryan, not yet two, was still a toddler. He hadn't learned to talk yet and seemed much more introspective. He showed little of the curiosity that Miles had at his age, and it often seemed as if his mind was elsewhere. He screamed in terror whenever we put him in the car, and seldom responded when we tried to get his attention. When we discussed it with our pediatrician, he said not to worry and assured us that Ryan would grow out of it. "He's not even two yet," he said. "Just give him a little time." In July, I started the process of soliciting literary agents. I sent out 25 query letters, and the first agent to respond, Teresa Park, was willing to work with me on the novel. The next 24 would all end up passing on the project. By October 1995, the novel was as ready as it would ever be. Aside from worries about my dad and the move, the year had been quite quiet until then. My sister had gone through yet another negative CAT scan, she was tested every 3 months, and my brother was doing well in real estate. My dad, if struggling in his personal life, was apparently functioning smoothly in his professional life. For a short while, it almost seemed as if things were normal. Looking back, I now realize it was simply a lull before the storm broke full force. While both my agent and I had high hopes about how the novel would be received, hopes were one thing, and reality was another. In my heart, I knew that I'd be pleased if I secured enough of an advance to pay off the credit card bills or perhaps buy a decent car for my wife. Anything would have helped. I was living a typically middle-class lifestyle with the same budget concerns as everyone else in our neighborhood. The mortgage on my house was $125,000. The novel, entitled The Notebook, was sent to publishers on a Thursday and Friday. On Monday, I listened to a message that my agent had left on my voicemail at work, one that asked me to call. It was a little before noon, and I was getting ready for a luncheon at one of the doctor's offices. I brought all the food, set everything up, and was waiting for the doctors to finish with their morning patients so I could tell them about the effectiveness of Lederle's antibiotics and antihypertensives. Using the office phone, I dialed my agent, and she came straight to the point. "You have an offer from Warner Books," she said. She sounded a little breathless on the phone. "And?" "Warner Books would like to offer you $1 million for the book," she said. I blinked, pressing the phone hard to my ear. Thinking I had heard her wrong, I asked her to repeat what she'd said. She did, and it was all I could do to sit in the chair without falling to the floor. In one fell swoop, less than 2 months before my 30th birthday, I realized that I'd just become a millionaire. How was I supposed to react in a situation like that? I had no idea, nor did Kathy. I can say, however, that even though I'd had my agent repeat the number not twice, but 3 times, I still believed I'd somehow been mistaken in what I'd heard. A few minutes later, however, my agent and I spoke again, and she informed me that the deal had closed. I immediately called Kat, but she wasn't in, nor was Micah when I tried to reach him. He happened to be out of town, or Dana, or my dad. None of them were home. And with the news of the sale still bubbling inside me, the doctors finally began arriving at the luncheon. Despite the earth-shaking news I'd just received, I somehow forced myself to talk to them about pharmaceuticals. Later, when I finally reached Kat, she was flabbergasted.
In excited moments, my wife's New Hampshire accent becomes pronounced.
"No, sir," she screamed. "No, sir."
"Yes, sir,"
I shouted in response. Even my dad, when I